Welcome to Fuzzcast. Let's boldly go into episode 3, the final frontier of punk rock chat, as we go Warp Factor 2 with Spiz Energy. Make it so. Hello, hi, I'm Paul Holloway, and welcome once again to Fuzzcast. In this edition, I'll be chatting to Spiz from Spiz Energy. We've got more to talk about apart from the hit single Where's Captain Kirk, which of course was the first ever chart topper of the new indie chart when it was number one for quite some while at the start of 1980. As well as that, the band released two albums on A&M in the early 80s, toured with the Banshees, Spiz worked backstage with The Clash, gigging at legendary Vortex venue in London. We're going to be talking about having Palmolive from The Slits and Lou Edmonds from Pill playing in the band, and of course meeting Captain Kirk, William Shatner himself. So we've got loads to talk about over the next hour. Don't forget, you can follow Fuzzcast on Twitter at Fuzzcast Podcast, and if you are enjoying this, then please share, subscribe, rate, review, whatever it is you do on your favorite platform for podcasting, and it'd be great if we can let some more people know. So without any more further ado, let's hear from Spiz. This is Fuzzcast episode 3 as we go Warp Factor 2 with Spiz Energy. Now, Spiz Energy is best known for the punk anthem Where's Captain Kirk, and having more lineup changes in the fall and more name changes than the Sultans of Ping. But Spiz is, of course, the only ever-present member, and pre-COVID, he's been gigging continuously since 1977. Is that right?
August, yeah.
Welcome. Welcome to Fuzzcast.
Hello.
How are you, Spiz?
Mr. Spiz, live on the radio thing podcast.
Mr. Spiz, now this is my first question. I want to try and clarify, are you Spiz Energy, Spiz of Spiz Energy? Where do you start and where do the band finish?
Well, I am Spiz. It should be just Spiz, but obviously I get called Spiz Energy because you have to have a surname on Facebook, and that's how it came. Started to become Spiz Energy, but the band is a one word, capital letters, Spiz Energy. When it was Spiz Oil, that people started to call me Mr. Oil, or Spiz Oil, and of course Pete Petrol. But that was wrong to attach. But it's just a way of people and nature that it gets lumped in together, really.
Yeah, but you've not helped by changing the name of the band so many times.
Well,
so
it wasn't actually a plan. It was just an organic thing to start with. It became a ritual by other people. It was forced upon me. No, because I started off with Spiz 77, and then at the end of 77, I was now working with Pete, and then I saw the oil rigs, and I thought, well, I don't want to be Spiz 78, and I don't want to be Spiz 77 in 78. And design-wise, an 8 is a difficult thing to play with. So I saw the oil program about the oil rigs being the biggest man-made things that move across the Earth's surface. Spiz Oil, and it was symmetrical for design. I'm wearing a Spiz Oil t-shirt now because it's my favourite. It shouldn't have that beer logo on it, but it goes oil, 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 oil.
It's a podcast, remember, Spiz?
Yeah, I know. Describe it.
Well, you've described it very well. Yeah.
Well, you could take a screenshot of that's why I changed the name to Spiz Oil. And then me and Pete fell out after a year of gigging with Susie and the Banshees. And so I got these new guys that I met through my girlfriend at the time. And so oil produces energy. But the Y, design-wise, was ugly. And so I changed it to an E, I, Spiz Energy. All before any energy industry had been called themselves. Because there's lots of energy companies with an I now, and they never used to exist. So they must have copied me. So the name changed then to Spiz Energy, and then we had so many lineup changes, 7 guitarists and 5 drummers, that it seemed, but we got a stable lineup towards the end of 79. And so what name, Paul Morley rang me up saying, what's the new name? And we had been kicking around ideas. So I just came up with the one I thought was the best one, was because Atletico Spiz 80, because the Olympics were, the athletes going to the Moscow Olympics were under a lot of pressure to not go. They didn't, Reagan and Thatcher didn't stop them going because of Moscow being a communist country, but they did put a lot of pressure on. And I thought, no, we support them. We've got, because athletes have a short window when they can actually shine, where, you know, 4 years later, you know, you're an also ran, or 4 years later for the next Olympics, you've lost that chance to get a medal. It's wrong. So we were in support of the solidarity, brother, with the athletes going to Moscow.
It didn't stop there, though, did it, with the Atletico Spears? Then the Spizzles.
Then it became a publicity useful tool when people, you know, what's the new name, Spears? It became a news thing. So we changed it to Spizzles because our manager was convinced, who was a big Beatles fan, that we could be as big as the Beatles. So
this Spizzle. Is after the Ruttles, was it? Well, that was Eric Idle, the Ruttles. All you need is cash.
Yes, I'm sure that's the way we were all thinking. No, we weren't. It was just our manager. So when we got kicked out of A&M argument over who would pay for the video that never actually got released, we went back to Rough Trade, and we thought, well, Spiz Energy was the most popular name for record sales, so we call ourselves Spiz Energy 2, like the sequel. And when Pete Petrel would come back in, and so the band had changed again. And it was more like a continuity of the original Spiz Energy. But then all things happen, you know, management, drugs, band, fallout. It collapsed on us. And so I was on my own. So I thought, well, 1984 is coming up in 1983. So I thought I'll be ahead of the game, big-headed. I'm always smarter than everybody else. I'll be Spiz Orwell in 1983. That didn't work, but there you go. I did one gig. That was the only year I did one gig. And now I've reached the same point where I've gone for a whole year and a couple of months now since my last gig. And that's never happened before in my whole life. I've always done a gig, at least one gig, like in 1983, in every year. And this is, that's just...
It's been horrible. I mean, the idea when we originally set this up was that we were going to go out and we were going to meet people. But we've ended up doing these interviews like this, you know, over a computer, because that's the way of the world. But it's been crazy.
This works in the format of a podcast or a radio show.
Yeah, it doesn't work for a gig.
Also, for expressing, like, I can see your face and you can see how we're expressing each other. You can't do that like over the telephone, just straightforward. At least we got some kind of visual communication, but. I used to have guests in the studio on my radio show, and it was a much better show, but you know.
Yeah, it's that non-verbal thing. You can see what's going on. So you're also Spiz's big business, Spizsexual.
So I went to backing tapes for Spiz Orwell, and I continued with Spiz and the Astronauties, and then Spiz's big business, because again, we started to get a lot more bookings in 84 to 85. So I thought, and I saw that Laurel and Hardy film where they open a shop and have a war with the neighbouring shop, and they put a sign in the window saying "open for big business." So that just amused me. So I thought, yeah, Spiz is big business. We're going to crack it now with the nightclub scene. But after that, I had another girlfriend who knew some musicians who just lost their singer took a year out because he got married. So the band were, you know, had a band with no leader. So they became my backing band, and that was Spiz Sexual in 1986. And I've chose that because Madonna and Prince were doing, like, you know, grabbing their crotches on videos, and their videos was all sexy and stuff. So I thought
weren't wearing a pointy bra, though, were you?
Well, I was wearing a codpiece, like a word up singer.
Cameo.
I had the cameo. Mine wasn't red, though. It was a sort of studied. It was sort of an S&M sort of look, you know. And I had American shoulder pads on, which I'd sprayed black and silver, Mad Max-esque.
It was the 80s. Yeah.
Well, you know, it was a culture looking for a style.
Yeah. I just made that for them. And it's a great one-liner. Spiz, the funny thing is, the thing against me is when you signed for A&M. So still an independent label, but a big international company. They had the Police on their books. You'd had this big single, and you went to them and said, right, we're changing our name from Spiz Energy to Athletico Spiz 80. Did anybody at A&M say, marketing-wise, you know, it'd be easier to market one name rather than the name every year? It was like, oh, Paul Morley from the NME suggested it. Well, did anybody ever have that conversation?
No, what they did, they just thought we'd drop the 80 and just become Athletico Spiz in 81. They just what they thought. So they'd signed us as Athletico. We were already Athletico. We chose them. Well, we chose they were the only one fishing for us because everyone seemed to be signed up. You know, Adamant had gone to CBS, Killing Joke had gone there, and everyone had been this, sort of like the next generation after the Sex Pistols and the Clash were getting signed up, except us, even though we were filling big rooms. And today it's commercially easier, but then it was commercial suicide in a way. Because, you know, you build up a brand. It's brand building, isn't it? The other reason why we chose A&M was because we thought they would look after musicians because they were created by musicians, with Herb Albert being the A, and I can't remember who the M was.
Jerry Moss, was it?
Yeah, something like that. So, yeah, so we thought that they were going to be a good creative label for us.
They signed the Pistols and then dropped them after a week, didn't they?
Well, yeah, well, that was another thing that Mayo attracted us, thinking, okay, they don't like mad punk, but they're quite like our sophisticated tuneful punk, you know.
Brilliant. Right, I want to take you straight back right back to the beginning, Spiz. So, yeah, I want to go back to Barbarella's, where it all started. So you're a young man in Birmingham going out to the clubs. I want to know how, because it's quite an interesting story, how you became a punk rock legend.
Obviously, I started to become aware of punk through the music papers. And then, of course, I started to go to the odd gig. And I think Vibrators was one of the first bands I went and saw at Barbarella's. I'd seen a few other acts, many acts at Barbarella's before, but it was seeing the Clash play there on July the 27th or 29th, 27th of 1977, which was an aborted rag market punk festival that was going to be a year after the original punk festival of 76 at the 100 Club. So this was like a bigger version of the punk festival, but in Birmingham, and the Clash would be headlining with several other bands. But that got 77 was when the clampdown was coming. People, you know, councils were voting to stop punk gigs happening. The Police would say that they can't happen because of the violent, terrible punk rock revolutionaries. Well, they were, you know, they were seriously scared of the youth rebellion going on. And so the gig was pulled, but they relocated to the Barbarella's, and 200 of us punks were saying, go to Barbarella's. And so we're going to play there. So we ran all legged it across town. It was only half a mile or something, but what, obviously we thought first come first serve getting in, but it was 1,000 capacity, so it wasn't too much of a trouble. And we got to see the Clash, got to talk to Joe Strummer, got to see your heroes, because normally 70s rock stars they jumped in a limo and were disappeared before you got out the box office. This was it. I got to see and feel real close to the punk thing, and the clandestine clamp down feel of it all added to the momentum. And then a month later, obviously the Barbarella's realised, I mean, this is great, loads of youths drinking lots of beer, so they put on this punk festival all day for the Bank Holiday August weekend. And I knew one of the bands playing, Model Mania, who were being managed by the DJ at the Barbarella's, so I wangled that I could borrow, because I'd only just started learning playing guitar, when that didn't seem to be a big problem back then. And I said, can I borrow your guitar straight after you finish? But I still had to clear it with the promoter, who was the guy who was the Clash promoter of the aborted festival the month before, Dave Cork of Endale. And I got to know him later and started working for the Clash behind the scenes. But I got on stage, I persuaded them, and I went on straight off to Model Mania. And an art school friend of mine did a sort of a performance art thing behind me. But what had happened is, The third division punk bands were a bit terrible, really, and the PA, and the kids were getting actually bored by the time I got on. It was a bit dreary, and I sort of I was one of them. I wasn't scheduled, you know, and I managed to convey something. I was equally terrible. I was, but I was funny in a way as well, and I think that I was a communicator, and I got through to them.
How long were you up there for?
Eight, 9 minutes.
And had you anything planned? Did you have a song or?
A couple of those minutes were after they switched me off, turfed me off the stage, and then the audience dragged me around and threw me back on.
So this is where your addiction to performing started, is it, Smith?
So I thought, this is better than art, because I was still an ex-art student. I'd just come out of college, and I thought...
How old were you at the time?
Well, I went straight from school to a foundation course, because you can't do a BA course until you're 18, so I was 18.
But no songs? Yeah, what did you...
You know? I had to make it all up as I went along. You know, because once I got to the point of going on stage, then I had to make it all up. No material. It was improvised, all of it.
But off the back of this, you managed to get a proper gig. How did that work?
Well, obviously, it was a packed house. It was nearly 1,000 punks in there, or people who wanted to think they were punks. And as I said, the DJ was the manager of Model Mania, and they were going to play with the Killjoys in London. And so they said, Spiz, go down and do your thing. You're funny. Go down there, do that. So, and it was the same promoter, but it was Bernie Rose was in charge, because they were doing this thing where they were saying, because of the clampdown and secrecy of everything, they were saying, the Cognoscenti Orchestra might be playing, which is like a clue to everybody that it might be the Sex Pistols or the Clash playing secretly.
Where was this gig in Camden, yeah?
This was at the Music Machine, which later became...
Camden Palace.
Camden Palace, which later became Coco, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a big old venue, but it had a 10-foot high stage. So I persuaded, I finally, you know, got me, I still hadn't got guaranteed that I was going on. And then I got, you know, I'm a big thing in Birmingham. Yeah, put me on, I'll show you. He said, well, all right, you can go on as long as you tell the audience, this is like a legal loophole thing, as long as you tell the audience that they are the Cognoscenti Orchestra, and then do your thing. So I did. Of course, everyone just thought, you bloody pesky thing from Birmingham. So they started tossing. So I started doing my stuff and being wacky, as people used to like to call me back then. And they were throwing, but then, you know, they realised that you can't have glass in punk venues. And so it's only plastic glasses. And they came flying at me and I nutted them back. And a manager of later to become the booking agent for the Vortex saw me and he thought I was funny. So I started getting bookings. My second gig is in London. It's ridiculous.
So after you played up at the Music Machine, Vortex was the next gig. I find this period of punk music just really fascinating. And the first episode of the podcast, we spoke to JC Carroll from the Members, and he was talking about how when he first moved to London, they'd go down to the Vortex and there'd be all these characters. So you'd see Susie Sue coming up from Bromley with all her mates, and Stuart Pearce, the footballer, he was there with all of his mates from Fulham. And there was this little crowd of people that would come to these gigs, firstly at the Roxy, and then when that got closed down, it moved to the Vortex. So I find it fascinating, because I'm about 10 years too young to have been at these gigs.
Yeah.
To see how all of these big movers and shakers from, you know, what was to become punk, because it was only sort of 1977, the Vortex, it was soon shut down, wasn't it?
Yeah, it lasted a few months.
I found the flyer, I don't know if you've seen this online, from your gig at the Vortex.
We played there three times. One's the Heartbreakers. Is that the Heartbreakers one?
No, it's not with the Heartbreakers. It's with
Killjoys.
The Killjoys.
Yeah.
You're down on this flyer as it's Spitz rather than Spiz. Is that a spelling mistake on their front?
Well, the spelling mistake was frequent. It was either I was called Spliz 77, Spitz 70, Spitz 77. Until it, because no one, you know, obviously the person who took the booking would have taken it over the phone and written it down as best as they heard it, you know.
Was that night with the Killjoys? Was that your first gig at the Vortex?
Yes, I think, because I was still involved with the Model Mania. Model Mania on the bill as well?
Model Mania on the bill and the Killjoys, they were from Birmingham.
Birmingham punk night at the Vortex, yeah.
On a Monday night. And Kevin Rowland was with the Killjoys, wasn't he? So Dexy's Midnight Runners. And also on the lineup, we've got Spitfire Boys. And that's Budgie before he played for the Slits and the Banshees. And Paul Rutherford from Frankie Goes to Hollywood as well. So all these names... playing in these young bands. That's what it was all about.
We were just chancers. We're all just people who are itching to be creative, and we didn't know where to go. And we ended up in punk music. Many of the punk musicians were art driven as well, or just bored teenagers like advert song. The 70s were a bit grim. There was only a couple of TV channels, and they were shut in the day. They were on in the night. And they closed down at 10:30 on a Friday half the time. So we were desperately needing something, and energy. We got all those hormones of being a teenager. Obviously, there was bandwagoners, older musicians who saw, "Hello, this is it. We could just throw away the chord book and get going." But that's the same with anything. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's people taking a chance. That's what it was.
So by the time you played at the Vortex, you weren't a one-man show. Pete was with you, was he? Your mate Pete. Now, is he Pete?
That's how I got there, because I bumped into Pete in Birmingham when my dad forced me to get a job.
So this is Pete. Was he Pete Plectrum at that point, who then became Pete Petrol?
For 77. He became Pete Petrol as we changed to Spizz Oil. He had a car and a guitar. So I said, "Well, I'm struggling to do all this improvising stuff, and I haven't written any songs." So we went round to his bedsit, because he'd moved out of home, and I was threatened with getting kicked out of home because of not being on the dole. So I got this really crappy job, which enabled me to bump into Peter, and he got a car, and so we it's a Ford Anglia, I think, some really beat up old car. We had a couple of beers and went round back to his bedsit, and we wrote four songs there, right there and then, you know. And then he knew we learned "Hang On To Yourself," and he liked Hendrix, and Patti Smith had done "Hey Joe," that's okay. We'll do "Hey Joe." So we had a 20-minute set. So we
did. You have any of the early songs in there yet, or the ones that became singles?
6,000 Crazy.
6,000 Crazy.
We wrote 6,000 Crazy, Red and Black, and what was it? 6,000 Crazy. But we had about three of the Spizz Oil materials there. And we obviously realised that we have to start writing more. So we started writing more songs. By the time we were supporting Susie in 1978, we had half an hour.
Right, so before we get to Susie in 1978, so driving down to London, Pete's driving you down. You're a two-man outfit then at that point?
That's it, yeah. Oh, well, then we, at one of the Vortex nights, Jimmy Percy thought he'd help us out. And he jumped on behind the drum kit of the band on afterwards. And I can't remember which night it was, but he splashed around playing along, jamming with us, you know, which kind of helped on some bits and was irritating on other bits. But, you know, hey.
That was punk.
Who cared?
Get up and have a go. Right. So how did that materialise into you being signed up by Rough Trade and touring with Susie?
Well, we started to do, because of Dave Wood's book, The Vortex, who was also the booking agent for a couple of reggae bands, reggae regulars.
Did he become your manager, yeah?
And he became, a handshake manager, yeah. And he, I just basically kept ringing him up every week, saying, "Can you get us a gig somewhere? Have you got anything going? Is there anything we can do? Can we play?" And
you were commuting down from Birmingham to London quite a bit, were you?
We were actually getting more gigs in London than in Birmingham, yeah. The pivotal gig was the Susie and the Banshees at the Roundhouse on July the 23rd in the summer of Straight Music. Used to do these Sundays where they'd have five bands on, where John Peel and John Waters saw us. And so we got a Peel session, because Dave Woods was helping out getting Banshees a Peel session, and John Peel loved the Banshees. So it enabled us to get on the John Peel show. And it was the John Peel show that Rough Trade heard. And then, obviously, the rules then, you couldn't use the BBC session as a release, so we had to re-record them for Rough Trade. And that was another back-of-an-envelope deal.
I've had a little listen to a couple of your John Peel sessions. They're available if you just put them into your friendly neighbourhood search engine. They're there, aren't they? You can still listen to them. And the quality, it sounds like you've spent some time. They take you down to Maiden Vale and sort of... It sounds like a proper studio recording. It's good stuff.
Yeah, we had to drive down to Maida Vale. We didn't meet John Peel until I didn't meet him until a couple of years later. I never met him until I'd had made several more records. But we just go to studio with BBC tech producer from the BBC roster of several producers, and you have to do it in the day. You have to start, get there at 10 o'clock, start. And that was my first time in a studio, was doing Made of Vale. I hadn't done any demos in a small four track in Birmingham. That came later. But this was my first time in a studio, was doing, doing the John Peel session. So it was all new to us. So we didn't know where to go. We just made it up as we went.
Amazing. That opened up so much for so many bands, didn't it? All the Peel sessions, and not just throughout punk, throughout music. So you did talk about playing up at Camden with the Banshees, but you toured with them as well. In fact, Steve Severin was your flatmate at one point.
Yeah, well, I moved to London. When I moved to London, March the 1st, 1980, I moved into my flat, which was my manager's girlfriend. Well, secretary, who became his girlfriend later, and her best mate, Ursula, and me. And Steve became sort of homeless, so we had a big living room, and he dossed on the settee for a fortnight until the flat below us became available, and he moved in with Richard Jobson.
From the Skids?
Yeah.
That sounds like a right punk rock house, yeah, like the Young Ones or something.
The flat above had the bass player of Girl, the glam metal band. he's like the Young Ones.
What part of London was this?
66 Priory Road, Camden, NW6.
Yeah, yeah. So a bit of rock history there. So what were they like, the Banshees? You had a good relationship. You obviously knew Steve very well. What was Susie like? Because she's got this reputation of being quite fiery after the big bust-up she had with John Mackay and Kenny Morris when they left the band. They were so scared, they ran away from her and hid, didn't they? What was she actually like?
You know, lots of little things impress you when you're a young, I was still 18 when I first supported Susie, and Susie would, you sound check, you arrive for the sound check, and a lot of it's just waiting around, and she was a little bit aloof, but not unfriendly. And then we actually got on with all the original lineup Banshees. They were, because you're working with them, then we're not living with them, we're not in the same tour bus, so we just turn up at the same time for a sound check and then do the gig. You don't have a lot of time apart from in between sound check and gig and then between shows. But yeah, you get to know people a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose some people might be a little bit intimidated by her because she has this presence, doesn't she?
Well, there was times where, the gobbing and someone might be pulling the microphone cable, which happened to me, and you get a bit of a red mist comes down, and she has had a reputation of swinging the mic and banging it on people's heads, and I've done the same. I've jumped into the audience and, I'm odd. I'm from Birmingham, mate.
I suppose that there was, I've heard John Lydon talking about this, it's a post-punk when he was playing with Pill, people were still spitting at him. He says, I'm not prepared to put up with this, this isn't it became something that some people saw as part of the sort of culture or whatever, but why should you have to put up with that sort of thing?
There was a peak, there was a time when I thought it had peaked, but then it did carry on in odd times and odd places. It petered out rather than ended suddenly, and sometimes you just I felt sorry for the roadies as well, because they had to like take all the cables up and the mics and the amps back into I saw the Damned and the Clash when it's raining. It looks like a snowstorm of gob. Unreal. I didn't care. I just pulled my t-shirt over my head and carried on.
They say the modern world is more sort of sanitized. Certainly post-COVID it will be. In some ways, that's not always a bad thing, is it?
Joe Strummer got hepatitis from a gob going down his mouth. And I've had gob go straight in my mouth when I was singing.
That's horrible, isn't it?
It's salty.
Yeah.
And it's someone else's snot.
Oh. So anyway.
It didn't happen this year, Punk Revolution, did it?
Let's talk about the big breakthrough, Captain Kirk. Yep. Now I've heard you talking about this. This song came to you when you were travelling around the bus.
When we got the John Peel session for 1979 as Spears Energy, we were still scrambling for new songs, and Soldier Soldier. On the back of Soldier Soldier, Captain Kirk's success was built. And what has happened is that during the Susie tour, I would read these photo novels, which are small books with the whole script of Star Trek episodes with speech bubbles with the script in. And I could hear it because I've seen Star Trek so many times. And that was 78. And I was jokingly saying, I'm Captain Kirk. And then I forgot all about that. And then rehearsing with the new boys, Mark had this song called Nobody's Who, where there was a line in it that said, oh, but it's true. And I couldn't work out heads or tails of the rest of the song.
So that's Mark Caulfield with the energy theme. He was your keyboard player. Yeah.
Well, we also, because he was a very talented keyboard player, and we compared him to Mike Caulfield, which is why we called him Mark Caulfield. You see, he was actually Mark Stevens. But I went home on the bus after a couple of beers, and I had the tune running around my head, and that line, "Oh, but it's true," as we went walk back to, and so the words were coming to my head. I didn't have a pen and paper, and so I was just kept singing them, and then I was writing the song in my head over second verse and the chorus, and then I got off the bus. I couldn't wait to get off that bus, and I ran home and wrote it down, and the third verse came then, and then I went back to rehearsals because we used to go and rehearse every week. And I said, yeah, look, Mark, this song, I've got the, I've rewritten the whole song lyrically. Let's see what you think. So we went through the song and then we all fell about laughing and we thought it was great. And we started to style it. And when we did our first gig with it, the audience just went nuts. And we thought, hello, we got something here. And so we released it in December 1979 as Spiz Energy.
I suppose it's the song that you're best remembered for.
It sold a lot of units and it got us in the top of the independent record label chart when it was formed in January 1980.
Yeah, yeah. So the new indie charts were launched and you were number one for how many weeks?
It says 7 in the history books, but we were already number one at Christmas 79. The chart started in January 19, so we would have been number one for 10 weeks, really. But it says 7 in the book of history of records.
Yeah, the big thick book that's got all the chart positions in it. So the thing is, though, that song, massive song, do you sometimes feel when you're playing a gig now, obviously after COVID, some of the audience will be familiar with Soldier Soldier and some of the albums you released, but everybody that's there knows and loves that song.
Yes, and
when that bass line,
how successful the song has been by how many cover versions there are on YouTube by a band that's trying to do it.
But when you hear that bass line, because it's got a great intro, that bass line, isn't it?
That came about by accident as well, because I told you we had 7 guitarists in 1979. When we start rehearsal, we would start with Where's Captain Kirk, and the test would be if they could play the intro of. It was meant to be on guitar. We got fed up, and Jim, bass player, he got really fed up. So he just cranked up his bass and played it on bass. And that's how a magical happy accidents happen.
And what was Jim's surname in Spiz Energy?
Solar. Jim Solar.
Jim Solar. Of course it was.
He was tall. He was nearer the sun. That was our logic.
There's always a backstory. But when you're playing live to this day, when that goes... does the audience always just, there must be that reaction. Does it make the hairs at the back of your neck stand up, or do you sometimes, it's like Frank Sinatra fed up of my way? How do you feel about it now?
They sort of know it's coming because we always do Clocks Are Big before it. And so Clocks Are Big, Machines Are Heavy, because that's only a short song.
That's like a wire piece off Pink Flag, isn't it? It's only about 30 seconds, that song.
Yes, it's an aperitif before the big meal. And it's not really until the snare drum snaps after the intro, the snap, and that's when everyone goes jump crazy.
And you still love the song?
Well, I did fall out of it, of love with it, because that was 1983-84, but I was still doing Soldier Soldier, so I thought, I'm still doing Soldier Soldier. I'm just not doing Where's Captain Kirk. And then I noticed the audiences were dwindling, so I thought. And I love the song so desperately now. It's to see, I could never do a show without it. It'd be wrong.
You mentioned how many people covered it. REM, of course, covered it. But unfortunate for you, in terms of Kijing and the royalties, it was a fan club giveaway rather than something that they put on an album. But what do you think of their version?
Well, it's obviously it's a fond they've approached it fondly, and I think they would have been more inspired by the Erga Music War version that we did live, because it sounds very live.
It's very punky, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I suppose they're trying to keep their feet when they're getting more sophisticated with their albums. They were maybe trying to keep a feet with their audience that they were still a bit punky underneath it all. That's why they did these annual giveaway vinyl to their fan club members only releases. But the bootleg, I understand, if I had my royalty check for the bootleg that got all of them on, that was sold on internet and God knows where, I could possibly put a deposit down on a 5-bedroom house.
But you haven't received that money.
I have not.
Do we need to write a letter to Mr. Stipe's lawyers?
I'm not a money motivated person. I do like to be paid. I do like to be paid, but
as
I'm not money.
A musician should. Yeah, quite right. So this song has, as well as being a punk anthem that everybody remembers, it's also become something which has crossed over, and I know that you're on both sides of the fence here, into the sci-fi and the Trekkie world, and is very fondly loved by people that love the films and everything. There's an interesting story about you meeting up with your hero, William Shatner, the original, the only Captain Kirk. And that happened very, very recently. Tell us about how you managed to finally get hold of him.
Well, before the virus was anybody knew about it, because you had to book your tickets for see William Shatner at the Hammersmith Apollo. You had to book the tickets a year ahead, and they weren't cheap. And I said, I'm not used to paying the top whack for top bands and top venues, because I don't like big venues. I like the intimacy of the 100 Club rather than the O2 or the Apollo. He had a gig in Liverpool, which was the last gig on earth at the time in the old way, on March the 16th, which was an anniversary gig for the closing of Eric's, which we'd played several times in 1979 and 80. Yeah.
That's just across the road from the Cavern, isn't it?
Yeah, so we'd done that, and I got to get from Liverpool in the morning to London against the two huge traffic jams that we kept pinging from two different motorways doing through country lanes. And we did actually shave off an hour's journey time by doing that, which we wouldn't have. And then we dropped various band members off on through to London. So we got to my place. My personal assistant came with me, Sarah Jane, and we went to Hammersmith, and about a third of the audience had not shown up because the lockdown was following that day. And the virus was beginning to pick up, and people were getting generally scared. And so I got tickets to see William Shatner. But there was to meet William Shatner, you had to pay another 175 quid on top of your 70 quid ticket or whatever it was. I can't remember now. So, when I went to the loo in the interval, Sarah Jane went down the queue to see if there was any returns, because obviously we spotted that there was a third of the audience hadn't shown up. And sure enough, there was these people in this queue, had two friends who couldn't go to meet William Shatner because they had COVID and they hadn't gone to the gig. They'd stayed at home and they were going to get the ticket. But he said the friends had said, if they see anybody who's a big fan, give them away. And that just by chance, Sarah Jane asked this, went down the line asking people and said, yeah, you can have them. So gifted tickets to see William Shatner. And I know Hammersmith Odeon layout. So when I said you have to go upstairs to go and meet and greet. And it was basically a queue of 300 people. We were near the front of. It was fantastic. But the other weird thing about that night, that was weird enough, getting free tickets to meet William Shatner, and you just stand next to him, you get a photo. I tried to give him, I had the record with me, and I was trying to give it to him, but he said he can't take anything, possibly because of COVID, but also if he took a gift off every single one of those people in the queue, who might have come up with the same idea of giving him something.
Hang on.
That's 300 items to take home every night.
Did he not realise who you were?
No, he has. I have read interviews where I have been brought up in the interviews, but it's the kind of thing he wouldn't remember.
No, come on. He might not know. He might not be able to recognise you, even with your glasses on, but your trademark glasses.
Yeah, well,
he'll know your song. He'll know your song, because every other chat show he's been on for the last 40 years, they've played that song as he's come in. He knows your song.
Well, anyway, I didn't have a chance to get the dialogue over to him about that because it was straight in, move on, next, you know.
Oh, that's a shame.
But the weird thing was, this was the weird thing, is when we arrived in the foyer, Sarah Jane, who I gave the ticket to, my second ticket to, she wanted to reward me with a T-shirt because I don't usually buy other people's T-shirts because I usually wear the ones with me on it. And we're at the counter about to, I'm picking out, I'll have that design, and I get a tap on the shoulder, and the tour manager for William Shatner is only the brother of the writer Mark Caulfield
from the Spiz Energy. So
his younger brother is doing the road tour. He's the road manager for the tour.
He should have been able to pull some strings for you. Something's gone awry there.
He said, which shirt do you want? I said, I'll have that one. Yeah.
No, the T-shirt. You want to be having a private audience with Captain Kirk. You want to be making a video with him, yeah?
Yeah, it was a strange time on the night before lockdown.
Yeah, it wasn't normal situation.
Wasn't kind of thing you could.
It's hard to pull strings, isn't it? Yeah.
So Sarah Jane was, that was another motivation for Sarah Jane to try and get the ticket from the queue, was because she wanted to buy me a T-shirt, but I got my T-shirt for free.
So you're happy end of the night. You got to meet William Shatner and you got a free T-shirt.
And I got a photo, which you pay, because I got the ticket, I get the photo sent to me. You go online and you can buy what size photograph you want, and how many copies you want.
I think he should have been asking for your number and linking up and doing something with you.
It's done with a company. It's nothing to do with Bill. But what I did do...
Oh, Bill, your first name terms. Yeah.
When I got the photo, I pinged it onto a reply to one of William Shatner's tweets. And he said, nice glasses.
But you're still not 100% sure he's twigged it's you.
I don't frankly care really.
You've met your hero.
My full circle has happened. That's all that mattered to me.
You want to be lining him up for the remake, reissue of the new video.
One thing that has slightly annoys me is that, you know, he's done a cover version album of like Pulp.
And didn't include you.
Yeah, but whoever put those songs in front of him as suggestions, why did the hell they not put Where's Captain Kirk, where it's actually almost autobiographical for him to sing?
Yeah.
Although sing is a strong word for what he does with music.
Yeah, I have heard them. If anyone's never heard it, actually, if you've never heard William Shatner, then just Google him and listen to his sort of spoken word kind of, yeah.
Yeah, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is a treat.
Brilliant. Right. So after Where's Captain Kirk? 7-8 weeks at the top of the indie chart, flying high. You went to Top of the Pops, yeah?
I didn't actually get onto the Pops because Rough Trade weren't a member of the BPI therefore were excluded as a not welcome in the music industry for being a left-wing anarchist.
So you've had this big hit, yeah? Your flavour of the month, you've signed...
It opened up a record, yeah.
You've signed for A&M Records, yeah? Okay. Yeah. So now you get to make your first album. And by now, you're Atletico Spiz 80. I've listened to the album from start to finish because I knew I was going to be talking to you.
And that's the album.
Nobody does anymore, though, do they, Spiz?
No.
It's a bit of a departure from where you were. It certainly feels post-punk. There's a real sort of keyboard-driven stuff in there from Mark Caulfield. It's a very good album. But the thing that surprises me, you're riding on the crest of a wave. You released a single, didn't you? Hot Deserts. Now the version of the album that I found, that's not on the album. That single.
No. It was recorded after we signed to A&M. The album was recorded before we signed to A&M.
Right, okay. Because no singles were released from your album, were they? The first album.
Well, that's a principle that we thought that you've already bought the singles and now we're going to bring an album out of songs.
We're not like the Joy Division album thing, we're not going to charge you twice.
Yeah, that's right. I would be just, you know, it's a value for money attitude, yeah. A lot of the thing about the album was that it was the songs that we were playing live and not were single material. So it is an album of songs that there's only a couple. So Red and Black is a reworking of the Spizz Oil song that's on the album, but it's a band version because Spizz Oil was a duo, you know. So yeah. There is,
that was a B-side for Cold City, wasn't it, when you first started up?
One of the tracks on the EP, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So that first album, you released that, and then for your second album, Spiky Dream Flowers.
Yeah.
Lou Edmonds came to join the band. This is sort of after he'd played with the Damned.
Yeah.
A couple of years before he joined John Lydon in Pill. So what was he like to work with? Did Mark leave between the two albums?
Yeah, what happened was Mark was disillusioned by the music industry, as it was Dave and he, both Dave Scott of guitar. They decided that they weren't really ready to be in another year of this band. So we got Lou Edmonds. We auditioned about a dozen, 14 guitarists in 2 days in the Clink rehearsal studios in near London Bridge. Lou was shone out. So he brought in a playing style that made you not notice that the keyboard was missing. Although he did put keyboards on the album, we didn't take him on the road. But his playing did change a few of the arrangements a little bit because of his superb abilities on the guitar.
As well as being a great guitarist, he's a very interesting character. He's now, or he was, I saw him playing with Pill a couple of years ago when they reformed again. I think I read or heard somewhere that when you went and did a tour of America with Lou, and what happened? Did he stay out there and didn't come back with the band? What happened?
Yeah, well, he had this cyst growing on his wrist, and it was causing him some trouble. So he said he was going to need to take time off and possibly have a surgery on it. But while he was in America, he didn't really want to come back to England. He'd never been, I don't know, he'd never been to America before, or he loved the scene, what's going on there. So he left by not coming home.
Well, was he legal and everything, or was he just like, oh, I like it?
Well, no, he's
rock and roll, isn't it? I'm hanging around.
Back then, yeah, your visa, when it runs out, you're supposed to be back out of the country. And of course, we actually overran our visas to do the Los Angeles and San Francisco gigs. Because we added them on while we were in America. We got those gigs added on.
Lou seems to me to be a little bit of a quirky character. What was he like to tour and work with?
It's great. It was great. He was, you know, he was flexible. You know, he wasn't rigid in like some people can be. You know, you got to be flexible in the road, on the van, in the bus, on the plane. Yeah, it was my first trip to America was to do a tour. I was the first member of my immediate family to cross the Atlantic.
And you were the Spizzles by then. So 1981.
We were I think it was Spizz 80 still. It was no, because I flew home the day after the day before John Lennon was shot. So that we
it's
went
December,
out in November,
wasn't it? Yeah.
We went out in November and stayed the extra week and came back and John Lennon was dead, which is my manager's all-time hero. And it was all very weird. And
So apart from Lou, the other sort of punk luminary who played in your band at one point was Palmolive.
Yeah.
Drummer, of course, for The Slits and Joe Strummer's girlfriend at one time.
Yeah.
What was she like? She sort of grew up in Franco's Spain and then formed the Slits. But fortunately for her, because of Glenn Matlock situation, she sort of left the band just before that album came out, didn't she? When was she playing with you? Is that just after that?
Well, I met her backstage at Clash gigs when I was working for the Clash, and I got to meet the Slits a bit. Me and Pete Petrel once stayed in Viv and Tessa's flat in Elgin Avenue. As you said earlier about all the swashing of all the various musicians in and out of London, and so when we were doing the Susie tour as Spizz Oil. We wanted to beef up the sound for Hammersmith, so we rehearsed up Palmolive to play drums. We just I don't know who asked her for. I didn't ring her up or anything. I didn't have a phone for years, but it must have been Dave Woods would have helped sort it out. we got her to play on three shows of the tour, with Hammersmith being the focal point, to boost it all up a bit. They did something recently about the Slits film, and there was a Slits film, and there was a night at the South Bank, and there's Tess there, everybody except Ari, because she wasn't around anymore. So I've got some photos of me having a laugh with them not long ago, including Palmolive. But she's turned to Catholic Church religion again. She's full on in America as a Catholic lady.
I think there's also this thing about the Slits. I mean, the Clash and everybody else, already there was this thing about punks and turning up and trashing hotel rooms and yeah, just the rock and roll lifestyle. But when it was women, yeah, because I know that you played with some of the other bands, Raincoats, Kleenex, and the all-girl punk bands. For some reason, people felt even more threatened, because it was like, whoa, what's all this? You know, so do you think that was the case with Viv and with Palmolive and the Slits?
I don't know.
I
think Ari did most of her explosive expressions on stage. I don't know. I don't remember any news of the Slits throwing TVs out the window or anything. There was an attitude that the Slits with the name of the band and the way they dressed a bit, Ari particularly, there was an aggressive feminist stance to the look. But that's that's where we were going at the time. And
off stage, different persona then. She was,
it's pretty normal for most performers to be black and white in demarcation of what they are like on stage and what they're like off stage.
And you've mentioned the Clash a few times. You mentioned, meeting Joe when you were back at Barbarella's. Any relationships with the boys from the band? How well did you know them? How well did you get on?
Yeah, well, as I worked behind the scenes on the Clash on Parole tour, I put half the posters up around Britain, fly posted the tour for it, which was a dangerous job back then, because you had to have one eye over for the police for fly posting, and then right, you were fly postering over other promoters' posters, and they'd break your legs. So I went in with the third of command from Endale, who were the Clash promoters of Dave Cork's operation. So I was backstage at a lot of these gigs. I even helped organise the humpers, the guys that help the tour roadies in and out with the, had my own humper gang. Me and Pete Petra, when we'd supported the Clash at the Top Rank in Birmingham, we went back with Mick and Topper to their flat, to their hotel room, thinking we were going to get lots of drink and drugs, but we didn't get any. I've been in a hotel room with Mick Jones and Topper, me and Pete Petrel, just chin wagging in the hotel room.
What sort of stage was Spiz at then? Was it?
Well, I started mingling with them from end of 77 through 78, and then I bumped into Joe a few times in the street. In fact, I interrupted an interview he was doing for Time Out, and then we have a quick chat, and then I think it was Pete Silverton said, "Who's that?" And I said, Spiz, I'm delivering packages in the big city. When there was a Keep Music on GLR campaign, when GLR and the Lord Mayor, the new London Mayor, was going
to
have
speech radio,
Yeah, and they were going to have speech radio and kick all the music off. So there was a campaign in 1999 to keep music on GLR. And we had a gig at the 100 Club, and I played on that gig, Glenn Matlock. And Joe Strummer did what I did. He made a song up on the spot with Bez dancing in the background. But he had to go clear off. He couldn't hang around to see my show, part of the show, because I was near the top of the bill.
You're on top of the bill. Joe Strummer's there and you're top of the bill.
Yeah, well, Joe had to go early. So he was on the stage about 8 o'clock, and then I was on about half nine, and then Glenn Matlock was on at the end of the night. But the funny thing was, when we first saw each other for years, Joe grabbed my face and gave me a big kiss on the cheek. And that's just the best moment. And then, that was 1999.
So it was a couple of years before he passed away.
Yeah. So, it's quite a big thing for me, that
everybody's hero, of course. Yeah, Joe Strummer.
If you listen to the Soldier John Peel version, you can hear and European Heroes on the first album, there's a bit of Strummerism's influence there on my vocal delivery.
All the people that have played in the band over the years, I think Pete Petrel, is he now living in New Zealand? Are you still in touch?
Yeah, no, he was coming back over from New Zealand. He moved there in 2007, I think, I was his best man at his wedding before they went, and he got married to a Kiwi, so they moved out there. And then, but he came over. His mum got older, got ill. He'd come over every year for Christmas, and I would rustle up some gigs. 2004, I think, the first year I did. We did a radio session for Resonance, and we'd played at the 12 Bar a couple of times. And we actually got some good bookings a bit later. We did one with Captain Sensible and Jonah Louie at the Dingwalls with, it's a picture of Pete and his daughter, me and my daughter and Captain Sensible. So he came over, but once she died, he stopped coming over, and then he was going to come over, and his dad was then poorly, and he didn't want to leave him while he was poorly. So we were going to have a 20th anniversary gig in 2018 to the Dublin Castle. But unfortunately, so it didn't happen. And then COVID's happened since then. So in New Zealand, no one let it go in or out of it, virtually. We still chat like we're chatting now here on the Zoom occasionally.
That's good. That's nice. And what about Mark? Still in touch with Mark?
Last time I saw him, I discussed with him about doing, well, Jim wanted to do a reunion lineup, but unfortunately there isn't an original lineup, and Mark won't do anything old. He said he would be interested in doing brand new stuff, and I thought about doing a duo with him, a piano and vocals or something in a cafe style Pizza Express type place, but no, he won't do anything. And then he runs a charity that he's committed to helping homeless people in Hackney. So he's not interested.
So finally, what's next for Spiz? I suppose, you know, you've never stopped, have you? All the way through, you've continued gigging all that time. The last year and a bit must have been really tough on you in terms of not having that creative outlet.
Well, just before the Christmas, before COVID hit, I decided that I couldn't keep doing it all DIY myself anymore. I don't want to do is turn up and sing. I don't want to book the van. I don't want to work out who's going to drive the van. I just want to be the person who turns up, sings. So I got a manager. I decided to get a manager again, and I was introduced through a mutual friend, and he's very good. But of course, just as we got the ball rolling, it all stopped, didn't it? However, we carried on. We carried on recording because we had songs in the bag. We had Christmas in Denmark Street, which we released just before Christmas, and that got us a little bit of a momentum. And then, because we had Tony Visconti producing it, mixing it. If you'd like doing that, and he did, will you do the next one? Which we wanted to do Valentine's Day, which is a Bowie cover, and he was the producer of Valentine's Day LP. So this is the first time that the producer of the original record is also mixing the cover version, and we've done a slightly spizzified it.
How'd you end up working with Tony Visconti, a Bowie producer? How did that all come about?
A film called Breaking Glass in 1980, and he was the musical director of the film.
That was Hazel O'Connor, Phil Daniels, yep. Wasn't it?
Yeah, correct. And uh-huh. I was had a bit part in it, and obviously had to audition playing, looked like I could play the drums, and obviously Tony Visconti was one of the people looking at us doing it. So that's when I first met him, and then they did the Holy Holy show at the Roundhouse. It's like a pivotal place for me. So we went to the gig, and I knew Glenn Gregory, Heaven 17, singer of Holy Holy, Woody Widmansey, I worked with on the Mick Ronson Memorial show when he was as the Spiders from Mars. He was naturally on this. I'm the most famous person no one's ever heard of. And, Tony, this is my manager. We've got an interesting idea for if you're interested. So he said, yeah, send me the demo. And then he said, yeah, but then COVID, we had to send the files over digitally, and he mixed it in New York, so it's international. And he then sends it back, and he said, oh, can you tweak up a bit more echo on, or no, or put the drums a bit. And so we did a bit of tweaking to and fro for a couple of emails, and then that was it. You don't have to tell him much. He knows what he's doing. We had Tony Visconti mixing my last two records, which great momentum, and it just fell apart. Nothing's happening. Three brand new songs to smash the stage with, and then we can't do it. Yeah.
Is there a plan to do some more work, maybe get Tony involved again? You've got new material in lockdown. Any plans to do
yes,
that?
We got a conveyor belt of songs need to be worked on, but of course that takes a snail's pace at the moment as well, trying to get anything. The motivation needs to be that there's going to be an end product, and that's still quite difficult. But yes, Tony will be first to have first dibs on anything if we can get something to him.
He gets first choice refusal, right? Yeah. Brilliant. Well, Spiz, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I hope that COVID doesn't keep you locked down for too much longer, and I hope that we're going to be seeing you touring up and down the country and further afield again in
We have got shows booked. We just whether they happen, we won't know till about literally a fortnight before, innit?
Yeah. There's no point talking dates. In fact, I've felt this for a while. You know, it's that thing that gigs you go into, you put them in your calendar, you rearrange them again. I think it's at this point of time, let's not give out any dates because they're likely to be rearranged. Anybody knows where to find you, don't they? But stick Spiz Energy with an I into your friendly local neighbourhood search engine, and there you are.
Loads of me.
Brilliant. And all your merch as well, because I can see you in your little cave. You design all your merch yourself?
Yes, bizenergy.com is your go-to place. If you need any new fashion items, I went to art school. I know how to design stuff.
And you've got a nice line in face masks as well.
Yes, I've been making face masks.
I tell you what, when COVID's finished, you can always sell them to Gimps, can't you?
I'm not afraid of them. I've been wearing a bandana around my neck as a Joe Strummer fan, because he used to wear one since 1977. Yeah, you know. So, and in cold weather, who's afraid of having something over your face in cold weather? Nothing. So what? You know.
Spiz, it's been an absolute pleasure. Take care of yourself.
All right, mate.
See you later.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much to Spiz for his time. If you've enjoyed the show, then please share, subscribe, rate, review, whatever the options are on your favourite podcast platform where you're listening to this. It'd be great if you could spread the word. You can follow us, get in touch. I'd love to hear from you on Twitter at Fuzzcast Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, remember to check out episode 1 of Fuzzcast, Sound of the Suburbs, with JC Carroll from The Members. And episode 2, The Oil City Axeman, features Wilco Johnson from Dr. Feelgood and the Blockheads. And of course, more recently, Game of Thrones. Wilco talks very candidly about his rock and roll career, but also surviving a terminal cancer diagnosis. So loads of great stuff for you to listen to there. We don't have a marketing budget, so please, be great if you could spread the word and tell your mates about Fuzzcast on your social media platforms. And we'll catch up with you soon for another Fuzzcast.